Coming up next, Native Lights. It's a podcast where Native voices shine, and that's followed by the KAXC Rewind. Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may listen at KAXC.org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Gordon Coons, enrolled member of the Lacouture tribe in northern Wisconsin. Gordon is a painter, printmaker, and fumage artist. And we talked with Gordon about his artistic career and pivotal points in his life that informed his work. So please enjoy our conversation with Gordon Coons from September 2024.
We have stories for everything. We don't paint a tree just because a tree is pretty. A tree has some meaning behind it. So we call Gijibajanoman. We tell stories. So that's what we're doing. We're expressing, as Native artists, stories that we want to bring out to people. And there's different ways of doing it, and they have different types of expression, whether it's jewelry, pottery, or basket.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Leah Lem.
And I'm your other host, Cole Primo. Meek Waits for joining us today. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Each and every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a whole lot of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, educators, language warriors, you name it. They all have this wonderful mixture of passions, each and every one of them. So we talk to them about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it centers around finding purpose in our lives and amplifying Native voices. Leah, how you doing? What's going on?
I'm doing great. You know, a lot of stuff's going on. Back to school, getting back into the groove.
Oh, yeah.
And just the seasonal allergies. That's about it.
Yeah, we were talking before this. We both have the allergies going on. Well, I have allergies going on basically all year, but it's just a little amplified right now. I did have a question, though. Do you like the fall season? Is it one of your favorite seasons?
I am a big fan of fall. I think It's the colors for me. It's the angle of the sun and the earth and the shadows. It's like the most beautiful time of year. It's nothing better than that.
Well, I also enjoy the season, but at the same time, it's foreshadowing what's to come, which is winter. And I'm not the biggest fan, but at the same time, the seasons are a great thing to experience and they give you perspective and all that. We're actually planning on putting up a bunch of decorations. It's our first time having, you know, Halloween in the neighborhood, and there's going to be kids running around and know it.
Because it's the first year that you're in a home that you've purchased.
Yeah, exactly. And we're thinking of trying to make it kind of spooky, put some dry ice machine, fog machine. I don't know. We'll see. Some spooky music. Mm-hmm. It's going to be fun. I haven't done that before, so We'll see how it goes.
Oh, that's lovely. A chance to be creative.
There you go. But speaking of the colorful season that we are in, artist that we're talking to today has amazing, colorful art, you know, inspired by his Anishinaabe heritage. Very excited today to speak with Gordon Coons, an enrolled member of Lacouture tribe in northern Wisconsin. He now lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He is mostly self-taught as an artist. He's an award-winning painter, printer, and fumage artist. And if you're curious about that last thing, it's smoke art, and he uses burning cedar for that. I can't wait to ask him about that. And yeah, he says he draws inspiration from his Anishinaabe heritage, as I spoke of earlier, and the natural surroundings of the Great Lakes region. And to talk about his work, you know, it's really diverse, Leah, right?
Yeah. If you go to his website, you can see it all laid out there. But he's got these colorful woodland style acrylic paintings that have those heavy borders. And then he's got his fumage art. Kind of reminds me of like shadow figures. It's really hard to describe, but kind of like heavy shadows or variation of shadows on paper. Really interesting to check out. And of course, he does block prints, but the styles he does, I mean, he's testing the bounds of art.
Yeah, and he's taken that art and brought it across the country, and we can't wait to dig into all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is.
Bonjour.
Anine.
Bonjour, Gordon. Could you please start out by introducing yourself?
I am a member of the Ojibwa, Northern Wisconsin, Lac Qui Rays Reservation I'm from. My brothers live up there. I grew up there as a younger child, and now I live in Minneapolis. Took the path later on as I got older to create art and sell art. As we were growing up on the reservation and watching my aunts do beading and things like that and make moccasins, I like the graphical designs. So I bring my culture to the broader audience, you know, the Western world, as they would call it. So I travel around the U.S. to different Native American art shows and other art shows that I could do. I paint in acrylics in the woodland art style, clan stories, you know, came from etchings and rocks and birch bark scroll stories, and I put those together with bright colors. I started out my art career doing relief prints. So I do those by hand. I don't use a machine to do them. So mine end up, actually the paper gets heavy because I use oil as my ink. And then as I try a variety of media, I have done using duct tape, which is really enjoyable to look at, I think.
Can you tell me about some of the things you're doing nowadays and exhibits you're working on?
So I curate shows. I usually have a group from the reservation I'm from, and I have traveling shows with them. Our biggest event we had at the Dakota Discovery Museum in Mitchell, South Dakota. We were there for one summer. I just finished a promotional curial exhibit at the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. I had pop-up vendors come. I had the Indian Arts Craft Board come out and educate people with brochures and handles of what is Native American art, how to buy authentic Native art. I just got back from University of Nebraska in Lincoln, Nebraska. It was their fifth show contemporary indigeneity exhibit, and they had 25 indigenous artists over there. And then I just finished I call them a make and take, where people who are visitors come in, and I have a 6x6 inch block print. I use water-based inks. I have 10x10 inches piece of paper, and they make a print through one of my block prints. I have 7 block prints. And they get to take it home. And then August 21st to the March 2nd in 2025, I have an exhibit at the Minnesota Marine Art Museum. It's called A Nation Takes Place, a show with just a few Native artists, but a lot of them are, because it's about water, they're talking about time period, slave trade, and they're talking about boats bringing people across the ocean. So there's a lot of BIPOC artists in the show.
Awesome. Awesome. We can't wait to get into some of the projects you're working in. But we also, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, we'd like to ask, you know, how are you doing? How's your family doing?
Oh, good. I'm old enough. My kids are growing up. I use my daughter's bedroom as my studio. So I got a small studio. So every time anybody comes over and visits, I have to give them a shoehorn so they can get in and get out. I've been doing good. I travel around. I had a couple, you know, as you get older, your little body starts falling apart. So I had some medical things I had to take care of. So I had to take, not consecutively, but I had to take 3 years out of my art business, if you want to call it that. And so I'm back in it. I've been to Santa Fe Indian Market. Two of my Cedar Smoke images got best in show for all prints, which was really nice. Takes me 3 weeks to get there. Because I do as a travel. It's a lot of work. You got to get up early in the morning to get your booth going and all that.
So, Gordon, is there anything that you're thinking about these days that might be inspiring to you?
I think the best part about doing these art shows is sometimes you meet old friends, and other times you meet new friends, and you talk to each other, and what's happening? When you do that, you get new ideas. You don't want to completely copy somebody's work, but they give you another path that you can do an expression of it. It's kind of fun, you know, to see and talk to them and joke around, you know. Little story. What I do is, you know, when I sit and talk about my image, and then you listen to the visitors, what the response is to your image, and that kind of gives you another idea of what else you can do. So I've been doing this like selling artwork for like 30 years. The problem with that is you meet so many people that I usually say I get a 50-50% of remembering your name. I'm really bad at that.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Gordon Coons, painter, printmaker, and fumage artist. Gordon's also an enrolled member of the Lacoutere tribe in northern Wisconsin.
Let's take a little step back. Like, what got you into what you do? What led you down the road you're on? All these exhibits across the country, what led you down the path?
Well, I started out, you know, like a growing up on the reservation. I watched my aunts, and most of my aunts do the beading. I like one of them would make moccasins. And I enjoyed that graphical design looking at it. So I would, myself and other ones would make things and we'd give them away. So it was that kind of enjoyment that you had doing those things. You know, you're creating something. You're bringing your, you didn't realize it. You're learning your culture and you're expressing your culture. Well, what happened then was, you know, as you get older, you moved a little bit away from that. You got to get a job. You got to raise kids. And then I always collected Native arts and other arts. And then I would buy them Native magazines and read about them. And I finally, a magazine, I read an article about selling block prints. And I enjoyed that when I went to high school, how to make block prints. And I said, heck, I can do that. So I started doing that. My first show that I went to, I had a museum exhibit at Lawrence, Kansas, and they have a university down there. And during the university exhibit, I sold my three images. I thought, wow, this is great. So I went down with, the next day was the market, didn't sell anything. And I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't do this. Maybe I should go to another path. You know, I didn't know at the time. So I scheduled to go to Bismarck, North Dakota. I went to Bismarck, North Dakota, sold a lot of images, enough to make me happy. And so I've been selling, doing that type of work ever since. So I've been doing this about 30 years. And it's very enjoyable. It is hard work. You do hear about that starving artist, so there is a little bit of that going on. Sometimes you ride the roller coaster. Sometimes you do real good. And other times you have to not do as well, but you got to stay at it.
So when I imagine making block prints, I feel like it's part sculpture a little bit into the linoleum that you're using, and then stamp it on. It's probably the wrong word to use, I'm sure. You know, transfer the ink over or the oil over. And then it's kind of like a progression. And then you kind of keep sculpting and transferring.
You know, I enjoy that graphical look and block prints give me that. And what I use is I use linoleum. And they call it battleship gray linoleum. So I buy the, after a while you buy bigger sheets of it, right, to keep your cost down. So I had these sheets and they can be, I've done some block prints for 36 inches by 36 and 30 by 50, you know, so they get kind of big. A lot of the other ones were probably 12 by 12, 18 inches by 18. The name, again, is Battleship Gray Linoleum, so it was used on probably battleships that they would walk on, so be quiet, right? So it's a softer material, so you can cut it. You have to do these things backwards, right? You come up with the design, but you have to create them backwards. My wife tells me it's a lot of the way I think about things. So that's kind of enjoy the block prints because you're doing things backwards. I say that my number's backwards. I'll go like 3, 2, 1 instead of 1, 2, 3, stuff like that. You know, so I'm always looking at stuff and figuring how they're built like that. And you have to design something backwards, which is fun to go through that. So I started out using oil-based inks. You just put your first design down, you ink the block. And I, what I do is I lay the paper on top, and then I have these little round, they're called spoons, but they're more of a flat Teflon disc. And I rub the back of it, pick up the paper by hand, and that transfers the ink to the paper. Well, then that dries, and then you clean your block, and you cut your next, would be your next color. And you ink that block, and you lay that paper in the same position. So the negative space is not covered by the next rubbing. So that's the layering effect. And the relief process is, as you go through that process, you're removing your blocks. So by the time you get done with all these different steps of coloring, your block is completely gone. So it's relief printing. You have a block. And if you were to make that same design, you would have to redo the whole thing. Start from the solid black background and then move on to the next color. It's kind of a one-time shot. When I first started doing these until I figure out how to register, they call it register your image. Now I keep my images down to 10 to 20 images. I don't do them anymore now because it's a lot, you know, as you progress, it's a lot of extra prints you have. I would do them before I'd live, like 29, 27. One time I did 54 of them. And I end up with an odd number because you end up dropping a piece of paper or you tip, end up tearing the paper. So you always end up with I always end up with an oddball size at the end of my series in additions. I got better at that. And in that process, I reduced the number of images I make. Because there are some rules out there that you go to the Native American shows, you can't have more than 50 prints in a series. You know, they got to be signed. So you got to have original work. You know, you don't go out and crank out like with a machine and make 250 or something. I enjoy that on hands work. One time I entered a show, and because of the thickness of the ink that I had on my paper, they thought it was a painting, so they moved it from the print class to the painting class. That's only based on the fact that the judges didn't have enough experience at the time, what they were looking at. But if you look at a lot of postcards, if just black and white, the words are black that you get to read. So that would be the first color you put down. Then you'd want those words to come out and a design. So you cut out where you want the words and then you print on top white. So that's how you would make a postcard if you want to do that process. So it is a sculpting. It gives you that texture. I mean, there's when they do these presses, you know, they got how many thousands of pounds they come off them. That's why they make it so flat. My pictures look more lively than a flat, mass-produced, like a postcard, you know? There's texture to it. You actually could feel it.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's a natural progression then from the block prints into your acrylic paintings in the Woodlands art style?
Well, I like that idea because the Woodlands art style, again, comes from etchings of rock, first gold stories put together. I don't paint any like portraits, 3D facial graduation of skin tissue. My skin would look all one solid color. So like when I was first starting out, when I made these oil prints, they got so high, they're like a topographical map. You can see the bumps on them. I didn't have any real good framing. So when I'd slide the glass across the picture as I made it, you could hear it cutting off the tops of my mountains in my picture. And I said, well, this ain't going to work because I end up with a bunch of little dots at the bottom. It's all a cut off ink. So now I make my own frames. And there's a bunch of stuff you'll learn. I think the most important thing about what I do is it just happens to work out. Everything is designed on size of glass. Once you have size of glass associated to your image, if you're going to cover under glass, everything else seems to fit. If you're going to use mat boards or whatever, you'll end up with extra pieces and you'll just make something smaller. It's a small progression, but you don't realize until after you've been doing this a while, there's things you can continue on with something. You don't have to waste as much stuff, whether it's paper or even glass. I also do cedar smoke images in that graphical design. So I have cedar, I light it. I have to do it outside, and it goes to design. So the blocks I use to do the design, create my images, I use the negative space for my blocks to do it. So it's the same process. I can handle that type of design.
I was looking through your website, gordoncoons.com. One of the images that really was striking to me was this Dancing with Raven Spirit, cedar smoke.
Oh, yeah. That's cedar smoke.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it's beautiful.
What it is, again, is the negative space that I smoke through. So when I start out with all my smoke images, I go from darkest to lightest. There's one image that I got, like I said, I'm going to say the best in division for prints in Santa Fe, but I had seven separate smokings on it from darkest to lightest. So dark first, and then whatever's lightest. So the last smoke that I transfer would be the background. I'm always, when I'm thinking about why do I want to do this and why do I want to express on there, but the one that you just described is I'm thinking of a person dancing. Behind him, he's incorporated kind of inside a raven. So he's dancing, and the raven, because he's a messenger, he's taking prayers from the Ojibwe person dancing, and he's carrying it up to the rounded moon up there, you'll see. That's kind of what my concept of that. So I do those kind of things. That one that you're probably looking at is more, I'm going to call it more fuzzy on the side. And now I got a little more crisper line because, you know, as you develop, you want to have something that's a little bit more not as open. Some people say, well, you should still do that. I don't know if I care for that as much. I sell a lot, and by the time they look at something, because it's all similar, and a lot of people say, well, I need something this high, I need something this wide, then I'll go and talk to them, and we'll create something for them. So I do that.
Do you still incorporate gold?
Yeah, I use gold for the sun, which is grandfather. So anytime I want to have grandfather images, I'll use gold leaf. So it's 24 karat gold leaf. What I'll have to do is when I make my smoke images, I'll have to cover that so that the smoke won't go into it. What I do is I put the gold down first, and then I use silver leaf or copper leaf for grandmother, the moon. So again, I'll have to cover that up. And I sometimes combine both grandfather and grandmother, and I call that image grandfather, grandmother. I have some eclipse pictures. I think about celestial movement, how that carried us through in our life. You know, we predict our last frost, first frost, celebrations. Celestial events gave us how to live in the world. And that's kind of what I want to bring out, those stories through my images.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Gordon Coons, painter, printmaker, and fumage artist. Gordon's also an enrolled member of the Lacoutere tribe in northern Wisconsin.
You were talking about the raven spirit smoke art, what it's portraying. Could you talk more about just the philosophy behind your art?
I think it's such a fine line to be too spiritual. And I just want to bring the idea of what our heritage is and how we treated nature. I mean, we have stories for everything. We don't paint a tree just because a tree is pretty. Tree has some meaning behind it. So we call Gijibajanomen. We tell stories. So that's what we're doing. We're expressing as Native artists stories that we want to bring out to people. And there's different ways of doing it, and they have different types of expression. You know, there's whether it's jewelry, pottery, or basket, there's historical reference back to those images that we create. So that's kind of what I try to bring out is these stories. You know, I'll just basically repeat them, and they're just different ways of expressing that same concept. When I first started using gold leaf, I did it first with gold leaf. It's so fine. It's such a fine material to use. If you buy original gold leaf, it's only like 3 3/8 inches. So you got to design how you're going to use that piece of gold. There's sheets that you buy, and there's 25 to a book. And then they go, there's like 20, 25 again in a box. So depending on how much you buy, so it can get expensive. You got to calculate how many sheets you're going to need. So when I first did it, the only place that was real quiet with no air movement was on my kitchen table. So my kitchen table ended up getting real expensive, because there's flecks of gold all over on it. And then one time I was going to the Bismarck Native Art Festival, art market they had out there, and I knew I wanted to bring this image, and it had to do with the Pajada Butte. Sunrise would come in, which is a spiral on the south side of the mountain. There's three rocks. It's called the Golden Dagger, and that's what pulled me in. So I made this sunrise coming on Pajada Butte. It's just a band of gold, you know, that you would see the sunrise on a butte. I was going to make a lot of them, so I made 16 of them, and I had 4 done because I had to, again, go through the stages of them, and I was going to come back and finish the other 12 images. Well, when I returned home, I looked at the paper, and you know how paper does when it gets wet, it gets fuzzy, and I thought, what the heck happened? And it's laying on these shelves, and I looked on the ground, there's a bunch of dead bees. And what they did was they came in and ate that gold, because I used egg to adhere the gold, because I was trying to figure out how did they put gold on frescoes way back when. So they use a mixture of egg. You puncture that sack, the egg yolk comes out, and I use that to brush onto my paper. That dries, gets really tacky, and then the gold sticks to it. So I have this paper that has egg yolk on it, gold down, bees came in. They ate it all. It was like somebody took a finger and rubbed on all of where I had all the gold. So now I use an adhesive, you know, man-made adhesive, so I don't have the issue anymore.
I didn't realize bees like to eat egg.
I was surprised, but that there was only gold and egg, and that was it. And I haven't had a bee problem since. So I figured it must have been the egg.
And I got to ask for your smoke art, like, where do you do that?
When I was first doing them, I make frames in my garage. So I had to do this outside. I wouldn't want to do it in-house. My wife wouldn't want to do it in-house. So I drag a garden hose to my garage. I have a bucket of water and I have a wet rag. So if anything catches on fire, I can put it out right away. And if my neighbors are outside, I tell them I'm doing some smoking in it because it comes out. So I have a form that sits on a table I have in my garage that holds the paper. And I have cedar stick that I light below. I did my first one real slow. My second one a little faster. And then I did my third one real fast because I thought I knew what I was doing. I set my third one on fire. I was surprised how hot that paper got, because you have to watch the paper, your design, and you're going to watch the flame and the smoke going. So you're balancing all these things. And what I'm doing is if you were to hold a pencil in your hands, like I have small cedar sticks and I have big wide ones. If you hold a pencil, you bring it in, it's a smaller smoke, and then you can cut it a little bit straighter in the line. And then when they get bigger, I just bring them in a little bit back and forth, just like they're swinging. And that makes the fills the rest of the gap. Like I said, I start out the darkest color first, and I have to really take my time to make sure that it gets saturated without wanting to set my paper on fire. I still set them on fire, but not as, my fires are a lot smaller than they used to be. And they're the same design, but each one is different because you can't control the smoke as much, but you can control the darkness too, but you can't control the variations of the lightness. And the paper is called Anagoni. And it's a famous artist in Italy, and they make these big sheets over there. And they're not like poster paper, but it's a little bit better quality, heavier art paper. So I get these big sheets that I have to order. You have to order them by the ream, and then I cut them down to the size I need. And then I just came across some paper, this stationary size paper, kind of big size legal pad, maybe we would call it, the size-wise, stationary that's used by the Vatican. It's really soft. It's like a felt blanket. And that also absorbs the smoke right away. And then I put my designs on that, the smaller pictures.
Are you experimenting, Gordon, with anything new recently?
I do duct tape images. I talked to you before, I do that duct tape. I use moon hubcaps. I don't know if you know those are for old cars, right? The rounded, circular, kind of like a moon. Assemblage of stuff on there. I call it Mach with a healer, but I put like for his nose, his facial part, I'd use like a measuring cup. His mouth, I'd have round, and I would use a silicone spoon for like his tongue. So it looks a lot like the Rolling Stones, that red one where he's sticking his tongue out. And then I use bullet casings on the top. And I put deer hair in, a different colored deer hair. So he's got a mohawk on the top.
All right, artist Gordon Koons. Just a fantastic artist, like so varied.
Exactly, all the different endeavors.
Beautiful.
Love it. Mm-hmm. I encourage people to check out his work, gordonkoons.com. Yeah, I love the mission of sharing the heritage and all. And
yep.
So miigwech to our guest, Gordon Koons, a painter, a printmaker, and fumage artist who is an enrolled member of the Lakota Ray tribe in northern Wisconsin, who lives now in Minneapolis. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lem. Miigwech for listening. Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin.
You're listening to Native Lights, Where Indigenous Voices Shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
I'm Heidi Holt, and thanks for being here today on People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Up next, it's KAXE Rewind. We get a chance to hear some of the conversations you might have missed. Up first from our Thursday morning show, Malachi Koons and I talking about grocery stores in rural places with a new Min Post reporter. Then our arts reporter, Andrew DeZingle, brings us a conversation about what Kichigami area libraries are offering for kids when it comes to art. Today, we've been checking in with rural journalists, including the KEXC Newsroom. Our next story is about the importance of grocery stores, food insecurity in rural places, and changes from the federal government on reporting of hunger. Grocery stores, as we all know, can be really a hub of communities, but times have changed. Malachi, you grew up in a pretty small town in Wisconsin. Do you remember the grocery stores there as something special?
Yep, absolutely. I, you know, was the youngest. I was at home with my mom. She was not working when I was little. And, you know, I just remember going to the grocery store all the time, you know, knowing the names of the bagger. There's this guy named Chad. He still works there. He was always so thrilled to see me and kind of knew him throughout my life, this guy. I eventually ended up working there in high school. But in my town, we had a co-op. We had the grocery store, and then later on we had Walmart where you could also buy groceries. And I think right around the time, it was an institution, but by the time I went left to college, a larger chain of grocery stores had gobbled up the small local one. And then I think now they've all closed. Now there's an Aldi and a Walmart. So there, you know, there's more options than rural places, but you know, even in that, my lifetime, went from small one, larger local chain, gobbled it up. That one then closed.
Yeah.
So now there's Walmart, Aldi, and a co-op.
It changes communities. We're excited now to have with us for the first time from MinnPost, Brian Arala. And he has done this intensive, in-depth article in MinnPost about, it's called Many Minnesotans Already Live Miles from Their Nearest Grocery Store. What happens if it closes? Brian, welcome to KEXE.
Hi, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, so this story you've done is part of the Rural News Network initiative from the Institute for Nonprofit News. Let's start with the personal. Did you know, you're hearing Malachi talk about his small town remembrances of grocery stores. Who'd you meet? How'd you find these grocery stores right now?
Well, yeah, him talking about growing up in a small town. I grew up in Chisholm, Minnesota, and my first job was actually at a grocery store at Jubilee Foods, which is still around. So this reporting this story brought back some memories from those times.
Ours was also called Jubilee. Sorry, I had to throw that in there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Small world. yeah, but for this story, which is called, or this project, which is called Sowing Resilience, we looked at food insecurity. And so my angle for it was looking at rural grocery stores, just knowing the role that they play in communities. And I was looking for communities that are small towns that are far away from the next closest option. And two places in northwest Minnesota popped up, and then one in northeast Minnesota. So I made the loop, long road trip to visit these communities, hear from the grocers, and found out they had really interesting stories and really central roles in their small towns.
Did you still see that there was a lot of community in these small grocery stores? Like that was sort of, not necessarily you're hanging out, but you know people and you kind of share the news of the community when you're shopping.
Absolutely. And you used the word hub, and it's a hub in more than one way, not just food access, but the bulletin board, the people coming in and seeing what's new and sharing the latest update. So it was very apparent right away when I was in these that people who walk through the door are familiar faces, maybe even distant family members of the people. And so there's a very tight-knit aspect to it where it's more than just a grocery store and a place to get food. It's also a meeting place and a place to stay connected with the rest of your community.
Yeah. What are some of the challenges that these places that they are facing that is kind of causing this for these ones that still have a small one, but what are the long-term challenges that they are facing?
Yeah, rising costs, always inflation, costly equipment. So if a refrigeration unit goes down, that's not an easy fix always. It's multiple thousands of dollars to do that. And you can't always predict, even though it's equipment failures tend to happen eventually. You don't know when it'll happen. Or there are already tight margins, so that's a tough one. And then growing competition and consolidation, which you touched on a bit ago, Malachi. And then upcoming cuts to nutrition assistance programs won't help either, because that just can further cut into those narrow profit margins.
So this isn't just a story about like local businesses in small towns. This is also about access to food. Can you talk about that aspect of it?
Yeah, so these stores, which are in Grigla, Greenbush, and Cook. All of them are examples where if that store isn't around, people are going to be traveling longer distances to get food. And there's quality of life and cost impacts related to that. So it wouldn't be that uncommon to find stores in Minnesota where 50 miles round trip is realistic to get to the next closest place, maybe even more, to get to a thing that's most comparable to what they had. You may have a closer option at another quicker convenience store, dollar store, those kind of things, but it won't have all the options, the produce, the meat, all that stuff that you can get. So that's really the difference, is you lose that personal touch of local stores, but also a long drive you would face, and that changes, especially in Minnesota. We know winters get really, really brutal in some parts of the state in particular, and you don't want to venture out when you're short on groceries or have that essential item you need when there's a bad blizzard going and you got to go 30 miles.
And you can't just hop a bus to go 30 miles. You know, so you have to have that access to transportation on your own to be able to do that. Otherwise, you're facing food that, you know, maybe from a convenience store where you're not getting much fresh food that could really impact your health as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It ties into those other aspects of rural access gaps with transportation. And we see similar issues with healthcare, where if you have to travel further for that, it changes your quality of life. So it really ties into those other issues as well.
I was talking to Heidi earlier this morning that, you know, I have heard about food insecurity and heard about food deserts earlier in my life. It was often in the context of like neighborhoods within a big city where they have, you know, less access to cars. So it was really interesting to see this through the rural perspective. Yeah, what, you know, you talked about growing up in Chisholm. What really inspired you to dig into food insecurity in these more remote rural places?
Yeah, this came to mind pretty quickly when the Rural News Network put out a call for pitches from nonprofit newsrooms around the country. And there are eight others that are producing stories that are also really, really good to check out and have different angles to this topic. But what brought it to mind for me was previous reporting. When I worked at the Mankato Free Press for 9 years before coming to MinnPost to cover Greater Minnesota. And we covered a Mankato, but a little bit of the wider region. And there was a store that started out, I believe, as a hardware store in a very small town south of Mankato. And they transitioned to also add grocery options. And it was because the town did not have anything like that. So people were having to go out of town to 20 miles plus to the next place. And it was a big deal. That community had not had a grocery option locally for a very long time. And so that came to mind, that I remembered reporting on that previously. And it got me thinking, where else are there places like this that have these sort of hubs in their radius that still do these things and are really big for their community? So past reporting really, really came in handy. And it didn't take too long to find good examples of stores that meet these criteria and would be interesting to highlight.
We're talking this morning with MinnPost reporter Brian Arla, and we're learning more about the story, the in-depth story that he's done on rural grocery stores, food insecurity. Now, it seems like some of the issues that we are facing are also tied, of course, to the federal government and what's happening with the federal government. You talked about food stamps or SNAP benefits, and also kind of linking hunger and how the federal government is sort of changing things. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you found out there?
Yeah, so many, as I'm going around the state and looking into issues in Greater Minnesota, a recurrent theme, I would say, is wondering what at the local level is being impacted by decisions at the federal level, how it's kind of being felt on the ground. And one of those is these supplemental nutrition assistance program changes, which are likely to make it a little bit more difficult to receive those benefits. And many grocery stores get a chunk of their revenue from those. So there's going to be an impact if fewer people can use that. And then also what tied directly into this story this week was the change to data reporting by the federal government on food insecurity. So the Associated Press, as part of this story, compiled data on food insecurity for every county that all of our newsrooms were working on. So we could understand and put in context, here's the percentage of people who are experiencing food insecurity in each of these counties. Now that data will no longer be available after October, apparently. And so that's going to make it a lot more challenging to understand what's going on in real time on the ground. And that's happening at the same time as we may start to get closer and closer to experiencing what these SNAP cuts will do and the impact they'll have.
So Brian, you mentioned, you know, growing up in Chisholm and the grocery store there, and then these grocery stores you visited. So you probably came into this story kind of thinking you might know what was going on. Did anything surprise you along the way?
What surprised me was growing up in Chisholm. Chisholm is about 4,000 to 5,000 people. So it's a small town, but you realize by going to some of these other communities how big Chisholm is compared to them. So it became very clear as I was getting into these communities that these can be quite remote. And so there's a tight-knitness there to the community. And you get a sense of, yeah, this is how far someone would have to go. And this is how big of a deal having a store locally versus not is. Grigla is a very small community, and they would go quite a ways to the next closest place. In Chisholm, it's still a big deal to have a local grocery store. You wouldn't have to go quite as far, but it would make an impact. But that was quite clear. And also the welcoming of these folks in these communities was really, really clear early on. They seemed really, really happy that someone was visiting their community and wanting to hear about their story and highlighting their local store that they love so much.
Yeah, that is wonderful. Before we let you go, Brian, we were talking all morning with rural reporters from our very own Larissa Donovan, we chatted with earlier, a reporter here at KAC. We're going to be talking with Aaron Brown, who reports for the Star Trib on different Iron Range issues. Just to you as a journalist, what's the importance of having reporters and stories about rural places in Minnesota?
Well, I come from a local news background. I worked at the Hibbing Daily Tribune first coming out of college for a couple of years, and then Mankato Free Press for nine. So coming from local news background, I'm always trying to champion and tout the work of local journalists, because I know there's such great work going on all around the state, and it's sometimes unsung work, but they're the folks who are going to the city council meetings, and like in Black Duck, I heard earlier, for that issue, and school board meetings and all these things that are affecting people at a local level. There's just, those are irreplaceable to me. So I'm a big champion of local news, and think that the best part of my job is visiting communities around the state and talking to people and trying to bring those stories to the MinPost audience, so that no matter where you are, you understand your neighbor in Minnesota better.
MinPost reporter Brian Arela. Read the full story at minpost.com. Brian, it was great to talk to you. Hope to do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Brian.
Thanks very much.
My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm the producer of Area Voices. When you're a kid, creating art can be one of your favorite pastimes. However, it can be a little difficult finding supplies constantly to keep creating art. The Kichigami Library System has decided that they are going to be that bridge to keep kids creating art with the art kits they provide every month until November. Joining me today on Area Voices to talk more about these art kits is Allison Royce, Kichigami Regional Programs Coordinator.
So this art kit program is part of our legacy funding, and I wanted a program for summer that any age could have. So from the youngest of our patrons all the way to the oldest and anything in between. And I have kind of an arts background. And so I wanted patrons to be able to experience having their own studio artist kit. And through the summer, building that kit. So by the end of November, you'll have start with the graphite pencils and then the colored pencils and then the painting program with acrylic paints. Then we have the oil pastels. And next month will be the gel pens and doing a design project. a collage project. And by doing that, throughout that experience, you end up with scissors, rulers, paint kits, brushes, pencil kits. And by the end, you kind of have your own art kit. And so that's kind of where that developed from. And I made it a regional program. So we have every single library in our region, including our two associate libraries, and also our bookmobile. So all those locations are able to access these kits through the month.
And so how long has this program been going?
We started in May, and we are going currently through November. And then we're going to switch to smaller kits that are more craft arts throughout the winter. So we've decided to continue with Crossing Arts. It was such a popular program, but we're going to go away from the big supplies of summer and kind of switch to more crafts and arts for the winter until we get back to the summer, May probably again, where we'll start doing another round of the art supplies again.
So how did Crossing Arts Alliance get involved? Did you approach them about this idea?
I did. I follow them on Facebook. And so I would see some of the things they're doing. And I thought that would be really kind of a wonderful partnership to partner the libraries with a already local artist group that also is a nonprofit and has classes. And I saw that they had kits that they started, I think, during COVID. And people participated in. And so I reached out to them to ask if they would make us kits. And they said, oh, we would love that. We would love to do that. And then I kind of threw the idea out of what I was envisioning. And so they were totally along for the ride and bumped up their kits for the summer because they're a little bit more expensive than the kits that they usually put together. And partnered with us to do this program. It's kind of fun, the different people in the different age groups. So we do have a lot of grandma and grandpas that come and grab a kit for them and their grandkids and do it as a project together, and same with parents. So it is one of those things where I always encourage the whole entire group and moms, especially because moms will get the kids ones and then they don't have one for themselves. And I'm like, I think mom should have one too. And so then they can sit down and do a project together. So it's been a really beneficial, I think.
So with the kits, is it have like suggesting what to create with the art pieces, or is it kind of a free form what you're imagining to create?
Each kit, they highlight a local artist. So it's kind of like their own postcard, which you can use as a postcard. And then you open it up and inside is the supplies that you're going to get for that month. And then you get an instructional page, which is a project step-by-step of at least one full project. And then after that, there is also that ability to just have enough extra paper or other items that go with it to then branch off from there and kind of be more expressive with yourself. And they do also provide a QR code in each one that goes into their YouTube channel. And so they have an instructional video as well from Crossing Arts. So you can do an online experience as well and get that training online if you'd like. And some people utilize that as well. And some people just like the instructions that come with it. So we have both.
So why did it seem like this was a good project for a library to have for their patrons?
Number one, it helps engage the community with their library and bring people into the library. Since COVID, I think some of the numbers have kind of drifted off and families started doing other things. And so trying to get people to remember, oh yeah, that's right, the library, and they have all these resources and all of these programs. And so they'll come in for their kits, but while you're there, you might as well look around. Then you start seeing the posters of all the activities for adults. There might be an author coming through the region. There could be a kids program like Climb Theater or Sparkle Theatricals. And so there's all of these engaging opportunities besides just getting the kit. And then also what we did is I launched a expanded program. So when you go to the library, for instance, this past month was painting. It was acrylic painting kit. So you got 12 tubes of paint, 10 paintbrushes. There were, I think it was watercolor paper, and it was kind of a cubist fish art project that month. To go along with that, I had a kids kit that you could check out that came with paint sticks, and it came with a board book set of artists that are for like preschool age. So it'd be learning art history along with another opportunity to use another medium like the paint sticks for the toddlers. And then we had the juvenile kit, which is a travel easel that has the whole paint set inside. And it came with a canvas and also a book. And all of those books then become part of the library collection as well. So after this program's over, those books will go back to each library to be put on their shelves. And then we also have an adult kit. So again, it was a travel easel with all of the paints, everything they needed, and then a book that was more for first-time instructional for acrylic painting for adults. So we're kind of linking our book collections along with our art program. And then we also have brochures where we have in our collections development, she pulls all the books in the entire region that are at all the libraries and makes a brochure that also you can grab and you can see, and it goes with the painting or it goes with the pencil art or it goes with whichever art form and medium we're using. And then you know, oh, those books are also available. And oh, look, I can get those here. And then she made sure to have what we call interlibrary loan. So if we don't have a book at a certain branch, maybe another branch has it, and you can request it and have that book brought in. If our region doesn't have a book, then we have Mintex, and we reach out to other library systems in Minnesota and bring that book up to our region for that patron to check out. So we make sure to kind of layer the experience of not just the free kit, but there's also a checkout kit available, and then those come back. We have supplies and we resupply them, and then they're back on the shelf for new people, new patrons to be able to check out.
You are listening to Area Voices. We're talking with Allison Royce, the Kichigami Regional Programs Coordinator.
So do you have an estimate of like how many kits on average go out each month?
We always run out, and we started with 840 kits. Then we went to, I think it was 770, but then quickly brought that number back up when ordering back up to the 840. So 840 kits are dropped every first Tuesday of the month at all the libraries, including the bookmobile.
So how does that feel for you to have this idea? And it's been a resounding positive success, I guess, for lack of a better word, of like, yeah, this, the community really does want to do this kind of thing. What do you think was about it that seems to have had such a positive reaction from the patrons?
To me, it goes back to even my own childhood of being raised up in the Lakes area. So I grew up in the Ideal Corners area, which is near Breezy Point, Pequot, Jenkins, and Cross Lake. And so when I was really little, our roads were a lot older back then. And so summertime was very lonely. You either played outside or you did art. And I just kind of, as a coordinator, thought back to that time period of what I would have loved to have had if I was a kid. And to be able to have your own paint set and your own acrylic setup and your own very own pencil kits, and having all of that accessible would have just been a joy for me personally. And so then I think, well, if I would find joy in it, I'm sure others would find joy in that. And it is really actually fun to watch. I do the Monaga run, and it's been an interesting spring and summer where at first I started and the kids were kind of like, well, I don't know who she is and what she's doing. And now just this past week, they're already waiting for me. And if I'm not there because of the smoke or something from Canada, they're like, well, what happened to the redheaded lady? Is she coming back? Where's our kits? And I always encourage them to each take their own kit, because sometimes families will be conservative on taking something and they're like, oh, we don't, you know, we'll just take two. And I'm like, yeah, but some kids are messy with their paint sets. They're really engaging in texture and, you know, squirting the paint and really thick, and they want to experience that. And then they might have a sibling who wants to be delicate and paint softly and have everything neat. And so I encourage all of the families and the patrons that come in, please take and make sure all the kids have, and the adults too, have their own kits so that they can experience the arts the way they want to and play with and experiment with, you know, gushing out paint or dabbing things or really working that pencil into the paper. So it's just a joy to see people be happy and look forward. And if you're not there because of the weather or something, they're, where is she? Where is she? So yeah, I find joy in that.
What would you say is what libraries bring to their communities?
I think libraries bring a lot of resources. Number one, our librarians are well-versed in all kinds of, whether it's technology, whether it's using the apps, whether it's engaging some of the kids in the branch when they come in, helping you find a book. Maybe you just even have an idea of something you want to read. And librarians are kind of fun like that. They'll start engaging with you and then maybe even bring a few book options out and tell you why they think they're good for you. I know we bring our daughter to the bookmobile with Val, and she'll already have a few books ready because she gets to know the kids, and I'll see her engage with like a 13-year-old, and she'll have maybe a graphic novel that she thinks the child, based on what they had before, would get into and like. It's a fun place to go because you can bond with someone. You can have interactions, like human interactions and conversations. I think the library just brings that sense of community that anyone, because it's a public space, that anyone is welcome to congregate and anyone is welcome to find the things they enjoy. One of the little terms we kind of use is windows and mirrors. That libraries are a place where you should be able to go inside and have a window to another world, maybe another state, maybe it's an animal, maybe whatever it is, you've not been exposed to it, and you find it and you're like, wow, this is really neat. I'd love to be able to travel and go, you know, maybe to South America and see monkeys or see things for myself, or go to the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. So windows, providing windows, and then mirrors. You should be able to walk into a library and see yourself there, see something that represents you and where you come from. Well, if they would like to participate, we still have months to go. In October, the kit will be pointillism. So it's going to be a double-sided marker set and teaching about the art form of pointillism and making imagery with just dots. And November, we will be having a paper collage kit going out. So there's still time to jump in and check it out. You can go to krls.org or find us at Kichigami Regional Library Systems on Facebook and follow us. And then you will see all of the kits that are being released. You will also see all of our regional programming, whether it's authors, more art programs, or you can also go in and follow one of your local favorite libraries as well, because they all have the kits. So and that would be Brainerd, Wadena, Park Rapids, Bemidji, Cass Lake, Longville, Walker, Pine River, Pequot, and Cross Lake, and including the mobile bus as well.
That's what it takes to be free, I don't mind. Still moving me. Still moving me. It's hard to explain how I feel. It won't go away.